morning. We welcome you, and I want to introduce our special guest this morning, Stephen Stein, who is a 1966 graduate of this institution, and who is right now Professor of American Religious History and the Chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, where he has been a member of the faculty since 1970. He received his doctoral training at Yale University, and he has published extensively on religion in 18th century America and on the history of sectarian movements. He is also the author of a forthcoming volume from Yale University Press entitled The Shaker Experience in America, A History of the United Society of Believers. This morning he will be speaking to the topic, To Be Remembered as a Chair, The Domestication of American Shakerism. In this lecture, he will analyze the contemporary situation of Shakerism within American society, detailing both the recent past and the present circumstances of the few remaining members of the United Society of Believers. We welcome Professor Stephen Stein.
Thank you very much for the introduction. There could be some ambiguity in that word chair today. I hope before the lecture is over you have sorted out what was meant by the title. In 1966, the Roman Catholic monk and poet Thomas Merton wrote, "The peculiar grace of a Shaker chair is due to the fact that it was made by someone capable of believing that an angel might come and sit on it." In 1984, Mildred Barker, the octogenarian leader of the handful of Shakers at Sabbath Day Lake, Maine, quipped in an interview, "I almost expect to be remembered as a chair or a table." These two citations epitomize the dilemma confronting the study of Shakerism today. The fascination with material culture is distorting the understanding of the Shaker religious experience. The current popularity of the community's artifacts is overshadowing the fact that the Shakers chose to call themselves the United Society of Believers, not the United Society of Furniture Makers. The fixation upon Shaker things is blocking from view the primary reason for the existence of the United Society of Believers in Christ's second appearing. To use Mildred Barker's own words once again, there is something special behind those artifacts. There's the religion. At times, especially in the popular literature, we look in vain for any mention of the religious dimension of Shakerism. For example, when the magazine Country Living described plans for the 25th anniversary of the restoration of Hancock Shaker Village in western Massachusetts, it told of a month-long celebration at that site featuring an antique show sponsored by dealers in country furniture and collections. The village also published a special brochure highlighting demonstrations and events for the whole family to enjoy: cider pressing, herb drying, weaving, candle dipping, and log splitting. Hancock Shaker Village, the article announced, offers food demonstrations and tastings as well. If you knew nothing more about the believers than this, you might fairly conclude that the Shakers were either early representatives of the Whole Earth Movement or founders of the Culinary Institute of America. In fact, however, the Shakers were a radical religious sect, the followers of Anne Lee, an English visionary and charismatic prophet. The believers, as they called themselves, denounced the world for its carnality and withdrew from it, retreating into communal societies. For that reason and others, during the 18th and much of the 19th century, the Shakers were hated and despised by many, if not most, Americans. However, whenever the material culture of the Shakers is the focus of attention, even in the scholarly literature, it seems that the essential sectarian character of the society's beliefs and practices is muted, if not ignored. The historical reality is transformed. The prophetic message softened, and the ethical implications of the believer's condemnation of the world glossed over. Most Shakers from the past would not recognize themselves in this altered religious mode, a mode that allows contemporary observers to warm to this tradition. For example, one scholar has affirmed that Shaker furniture is religious furniture. Helen Upton writes, and I am quoting, "One can feel the sincerity, the drive for perfection, the dedication to religious principles when studying a fingered box, a kitten head basket, a whisk broom with its delicately tapered handle, a wall cabinet built to hold tools." She continues, "It's an experience not felt by everyone, but if one has felt it, that person understands the tremendous attraction things Shaker have for some of us." Helen Upton is describing a religious experience, her religious experience, not that of the Shakers. In this presentation, I want to examine with you the surge of interest in the society in the recent past and explore the contemporary situation of the Shakers. I will describe the outlook of the believers today and contrast their situation with their popular image. In doing so, I hope to probe the implications of the popularity of Shakerism and of its domestication for our understanding of contemporary American religion and culture. But first, let me briefly sketch their history for those of you who may be unfamiliar with it. After several years of conflict with civil and ecclesiastical authorities in England, Ann Lee and a group of eight like-minded Shaking Quakers, as they were called, came to America in 1774. 2 years later, according to land records, this group of dissenters was located outside Albany, New York. But they remained almost unnoticed there until 1780, when they were accused of supporting the Tory cause during the American Revolution. Pacifists they were, but not Tories, and after a short stay in jail, they were released. Soon they were attracting another kind of attention, as religious seekers learned of their distinctive beliefs and practices. The English Shakers were especially successful in drawing converts from the ranks of evangelicals and dissenters in eastern New York and throughout New England. For a period of 2 years, in 1781 to 83, Ann Lee and some of her closest associates traveled throughout New England, attracting both followers and opponents. That missionary journey established the base for an expanding society. 1 year later, in 1784, Ann Lee died. But the community she had attracted did not die with her. On the contrary, the years between 1787 and 1826 witnessed both numerical and geographical expansion of Lee's disciples. They proclaimed an urgent message, condemning as carnal the social structures of the world, including marriage and a family. For them, the sex act was the original sin. They called for withdrawal from the world, both physical and psychological withdrawal, and mandated a celibate communal lifestyle. The American believers spread the Shaker gospel and carried their alternative social order as far east as Maine and as far west as the Wabash River in Indiana. Imbued with religious zeal and committed to a joint interest instead of their own private welfare, the Shakers established highly successful communities which attracted growing numbers. They also evolved a unique set of beliefs and religious practices. They affirmed, for example, the duality of God, one spirit comprised of eternal power and infinite wisdom, a male and a female aspect. They found this same duality reflected in all of creation. Likewise, they came to regard Ann Lee of Manchester as the beloved daughter and Jesus of Nazareth as the beloved Son of God. Both were filled with the Christ Spirit, a spirit equally available to all believers. The Shakers constituted themselves a new family governed by elders and elderesses. Shaker worship, expressed in both song and dance, also set them apart from other Christians. The believers were often the object object of ridicule, harassment, and persecution. During the middle years of the 19th century, the Shakers experienced expanding economic success, growing involvement with the outside world, and intermittent periods of religious revival. The most unusual religious development of this period occurred in the 1830s and 1840s, when the entire society was convulsed by a series of spiritualistic revivals in which charismatic gifts, ecstatic behavior, and messages from the spirit world overwhelmed the membership. This was a time of heightened creative theological activity and ritualistic innovation. In some villages, this religious outpouring continued through the years of the Civil War. The story of a society after 1865 is one of rapid change, including numerical decline, geographical retreat, and changing religious values. Many of the believers abandoned the idea of withdrawal from the world and joined progressives outside the society who hoped to reform the world through social action. The membership literally began to die out, and villages were closed. In 1845, there had been about 4,500 Shakers in 19 villages. By 1947, approximately a century later, when the headquarters in New Lebanon, New York was closed, there were only 3 remaining villages in New England with less than 100 members, most of whom were elderly women. Today, there are 9 living Shakers at 2 villages, literally the same number that came to America in 1774. Here ends the historical excursus. I feel like I need to have theological language here. Now to return to the surge of interest in the society in recent decades. Today, the Shakers are enjoying unprecedented popularity. The members of the United Society of Believers have been both a curiosity and an attraction for nearly 2 centuries, but the current wave of interest is higher than ever before. Television documentaries and news clips, cookbooks for those in the kitchen, coloring books for children, gift books for the coffee table, how-to-do-it kits for those who are handy or not so handy, doctoral dissertations and edited texts, antique shows, and a whole cottage industry devoted to making replicas, record-breaking attendances at more than 10 museums and historic restorations, high-priced seminars for hobbyists and antique dealers, informal study groups spread from coast to coast, a semi-scholarly journal for serious students, a separate quarterly publication for Shaker buffs. These all confirm that the Shakers are a growth industry today. Americans have taken this small society into their hearts and into their homes and have adopted it as family and are literally buying stock in the enterprise. In no way is this clearer than in the area of collectibles. The Shaker antique and replica industries, which exist in a kind of symbiosis, are both thriving today. Authentic Shaker pieces command astonishing prices at auctions and with antique dealers, prices so high that relatively few can contemplate owning them. But the manufacturers of replicas, both those who sell finished products and those who provide kits, put the lookalikes, or the almost lookalikes, within the reach of the rest of us. Old pieces and modern counterfeits alike enjoy the advantage of association with Shakerism. The prices of both rise with the surge in Shakerana. This mutual reinforcement of the perceived value of Shaker antiques and reproductions is evident on the pages of the Shaker Messenger, a quarterly publication designed to inform and nurture the commitment of those who feel a part of this world of Shaker, as it is called. The market for Shaker antiques shows no sign of softening. Small items carry large price tags, $420 for a 5-foot section of peg railing, $600 for a bottle with a label reading Shaker Pickles, no pickles inside, $1,200 for a grain pail, $5,000 for an oval sewing box, 3 5/8 inches long. $15,000 for a Shaker peg leg stand. $39,000 for an Eldris's desk. $82,000 for a trestle table. Every issue of the Shaker Messenger reports new highs reached by Shaker artifacts. These rising prices create the sensation of fiscal vertigo. The annual Willis Henry auction sets the contemporary gold standard for all Shaker exchanges. This past summer, that auction attracted national media attention when talk show host Oprah Winfrey paid $220,000 for a simple three-drawer pine work counter, approximately 3 feet long and 2.5 feet high. For those who like Shaker things, but not quite that much, the makers of Shaker lookalikes are ready and willing to supply your every need. For example, at the Shaker Seed Box Company in Cincinnati, you can purchase reproductions of Shaker furniture and accessories of all kinds, wall clocks, Shaker chairs, tinware, cupboard, and oval boxes. Often it is impossible, even for the experts, to distinguish antiques from reproductions. One Shaker oblong carrier sold as an antique for $3,800 in 1985 in an auction before it was discovered that it had been made 2 years earlier by the craftsman at Hancock Restoration. Maybe you will be satisfied with something simply in the Shaker tradition, whether it be a household item, a recipe, or a piece of stitchery. Items linked with the Shaker name are almost countless. I have several file folders crammed with clippings from magazines that my mother in Michigan has been saving for me over the past 7 years. She sends me everything having to do with the Shakers or with anything called Shaker or items merely associated with the name. I have clippings marketing needlework and kitchen utensils, herbal teas and house paint, Shaker knit sweaters, and gadgets and furnishings of all kinds. The wave of Shakerana has become a flood tide of Shaker mania. In virtually all of this contemporary literature, the image of the society is highly favorable. The following citation from a contemporary handbook on Shakerism is representative. Diana Van Kalken writes, and I quote, "For over 200 years, the Shakers have lived quietly in secluded communities, sharing a simple life and seeking perfection in everything they do, from cooking to carpentry. Dedicated to the glory of God," she continues, "Shaker perfectionism can be seen in the serene beauty of their villages, in the gracefulness of their furniture and crafts, and in their qualities of life and character, devotion, thrift, humanity, ingenuity." She continues, "America is a land of pioneers, dreamers, and idealists who dared to explore new frontiers and create a new society. The Shakers were spiritual pioneers, and when we look at them, we see something of ourselves." End quote. Van Kalken's comments are instructive. She would have us see the Shakers as simple and serene, idealistic and ingenious, seeking perfection in every pursuit, brothers in the shop crafting chairs, sisters in the kitchen preparing their meals, singing as they sweat, 'tis the gift to be simple. Indeed, in the Shakers, she writes, "we see ourselves pioneers, Shakers and movers, so to speak." And she implies, we like what we see both in them and in ourselves. Lest we dismiss Van Kalken's observations as sophomoric, let me quote from an award-winning volume by a most respected historian of American religion. "These Shaker communities," he wrote, and I now quote, "became one of the American marvels. In a simple Yankee way, these Shaker villages were in fact idyllic. The wants of life were fully, even abundantly supplied. The clean-lined, functional buildings, spotless interiors, gracefully practical furniture, wonderful cattle herds, fine herb gardens, and perfectly tended fields, all witness to organizational, social, and economic success." The late Sidney Ahlstrom, author of these judgments, and also, incidentally, my teacher, also liked what he saw. the author of a catalog that accompanied the spectacular display of Shaker material culture exhibited at museums in New York City and Washington, D.C. in 1986 and 87, concluded from her observation of those pieces that life in Shaker villages was serene and peaceful, unencumbered by everyday concerns or worries. June Sprigg wrote, "To a degree that we can scarcely imagine, the Shakers were free of distractions. They stayed at home, worked quietly, and gave a part of each day to meditation. They eliminated the tyranny of petty decisions. Communal life provided uniform clothing, meals, a daily routine, and job assignments. It also," she continues, "freed them from financial worries. No one relied on his or her own work for survival, and none made cheap, second-rate goods to get by. With ample workspace, the best of materials, and business-minded colleagues to market what they made, Shaker artisans could concentrate wholly on their work. For Sprigg, the objects produced were a perfect mirror of an ideal Shaker life. As she puts it, among the believers, the line between heaven and earth flickered and danced." I assume by now that you have sensed that I disagree with these assessments of Shaker life and material culture. So what's wrong with this revival of interest in the Shakers and the favorable assessment of their material culture? Nothing, perhaps. I think it is a positive trend, and I want this affirmed, when thousands display a curiosity about American history that keeps some of us in business. There's also nothing wrong when even larger numbers are attracted by the rich heritage of Shaker material culture. Nor is anything amiss, in my opinion, when all of these activities, for profit and not for profit, turn a handsome profit. What is bothersome to me as a historian, however, is that much of this renaissance of interest rests upon a highly selective, idealized, romanticized image of the believers. The preoccupation with things Shaker has obscured and distorted the believers' experience. It has encouraged the creation and perpetuation of an image of a mythical Shaker. The link between the contemporary fixation upon Shaker material culture and a sloppy understanding of the society's history seems all too obvious. During the past several years, I have systematically visited Shaker museums and historic sites as part of my research on Shakerism. At one time or another, I have heard guides, after they have completed their canned speeches, describe Ann Lee as an evangelical Christian, the Shakers as similar to the Amish, and the believers as champions of individual liberty. For the record, Ann Lee condemned evangelical churches and Christians, as well as the other religious communities of her day, denouncing them as part of the anti-Christian empire. Nothing could be more disparate than the Shaker practice of celibacy and the Amish rites of courtship, including bundling, and marriage with many children. Even the attitude of those two groups toward worldly technology is radically different. The idea that the believers favored individual liberty is patently false. Their communal system required unquestioning obedience to the ministry, who exercised almost autocratic authority. The simplistic, romanticized view of the Shakers that prevails today bears little resemblance to the realities of the past. It is impossible to read the Shaker record in its entirety, including more than just the material objects that remain, and still maintain the naive judgment that life was serene in the villages, that a spiritual consensus prevailed among the believers on all issues, that the Shakers did not worry and fret about the same distractions as their counterparts in the world. The tyranny of life, in fact, operated within the society, too. One of the best measures of the factious climate in the various villages is the voluminous correspondence exchanged among the settlements. Hundreds of letters from every period of Shaker history underscore the perpetual problems that confronted the believers. Extensive family journals also document conflict between the younger members of the community and the leadership. arguments concerning the allocation of resources, discontent stemming from overwork and inadequate working conditions, petty jealousies concerning privileges, personality problems, financial misdealings by deacons and trustees, incompetence on a variety of levels, funds lost through theft, embezzlement, and speculation, worries about sufficient supplies of food and raw materials, and frankly, the list could go on endlessly. My point is not to disparage the Shaker ideal or to criticize the believers. My point is to burst the illusion that the Shakers live in a trouble-free society and that the products of their hands are a direct reflection of a utopia achieved. Shakerism, in fact, resembled in striking ways the world that it set out to leave behind. Shaker productions may therefore be all the more remarkable because they were produced under circumstances that were anything but ideal. The most striking proof of the fact that the Shakers are not to be viewed through rose-tinted glasses is the circumstances of the believers over the past three decades. What is the situation of the Shakers today? At one of the two remaining villages in Canterbury, New Hampshire, the seat of the parent ministry until the death of the last Shaker elderess late in 1990, there is, at that village, one single believer, Ethel Hudson, a 94-year-old woman who has lived for decades in isolation as a recluse. She is being cared for by the staff of Shaker Village Incorporated, the nonprofit museum corporation formed several decades ago. Even when the last two members of the parent ministry were alive, the Shakers at Canterbury had ceased living as a communal society. They had also given up most of what made them a distinctive religious community. The handful of women who remained in the New Hampshire location occasionally attended local Protestant churches in the area. They maintained private devotional practices that resembled an evangelical spirituality, and they expressed their delight intermittently with a number of diverse religious ideas ranging from spiritualism to Robert Schuller's possibility thinking. Bertha Lindsay, the last elderess at Canterbury, spoke from time to time about contemporary Shaker beliefs. She wrote, "We are simple people who believe in Christ. Like good Christians everywhere, if we live by his teachings, we are good people and good Shakers. We feel that the Christ spirit comes to each person individually, differently, not at the same time. Anyone can live a Shaker life anywhere because it's very simple. Just live by the teachings of Christ and meet everyone in a brotherly spirit with a lot of love because that is what the world needs today." She continued, "I don't think Shakers are different in the least from other Christian sects because we do believe in Christ's teachings and we believe in the Bible." Clearly by 1960, the Shakers at Canterbury, one of these two villages, had left behind most of the distinctive beliefs and practices of the society. The religious situation at the other remaining village, Sabbath Day Lake, Maine, is very different. Today, there are eight Shakers present in that family, ranging in age from nearly 90 down to about 30. Six are women, two very elderly, two in their 60s, and two in their late 30s, and two are young men in their late 20s and mid-30s, respectively. The Shakers in Maine continue to live in communal life, practicing the joint interest, celibacy, obedience, and religious commitment. The leader of this family now is Frances Carr, a woman in her early 60s who has been a Shaker since the age of 9. On her shoulders now rests the direction of this small group. Beginning, however, in the 1960s, Sabbath Day Lake underwent a spiritual renaissance. In that decade, Theodore E. Johnson, an outsider, became a part of the family, first as a friend and helper, and then later as a convert and fellow Shaker. He brought skills, training, and experience to the community from the world, and soon he emerged as the chief spokesperson for the main believers. He grafted onto the Shaker tradition biblical, liturgical, and ecumenical interests formed in his early years as an Episcopalian. Under his leadership, the main believers began holding public meetings again and attracting a host of kindred spirits to those meetings. And I don't mean spirits, I mean people spirits. Just make sure that that's clear. As a result of Johnson's influence, the spirituality of the main believers has become an amalgam of Shaker tradition and ecumenical Christianity. Worship services include the reading of the liturgical lessons side by side with the singing of Shaker hymns and the offering of testimonies by members of the society. Gone are the dances and marches, as well as the ecstatic possession of earlier times. Theodore Johnson saw the Shaker Church as, and this is his word, but a part of the underlined church. For him, it represented a revival of apostolic Christianity shaped by the spiritual experiences of Ann Lee. The believers were called to witness to holiness through lives of humility and love as taught in the New Testament. The Spirit of Christ in their midst was to produce unity, community of goods, and the acceptance of authority. Johnson contended that the Shaker traditions were not out of place today. He wrote, "Shakerism has a message for the 20th century. A message as valid today as when it was first expressed. Shakerism teaches God's immanence through the common life shared in Christ's mystical body." End quote. For Johnson, God possesses both male characteristics of strength and power, as well as the female characteristics of compassion and mercy. He believed that the second coming of Christ was in the church. Johnson called Shakerism supra-sacramental because the baptism of the Holy Spirit is more important than water baptism, and every meal that is shared is a Eucharist. Shakerism thus becomes a way of life characterized by absolute surrender to the will of Christ, according to this perspective. The religious patterns at Canterbury and Sabbath Day Lake have been very different for several decades. That's not all that separates the two villages. Ever since Theodore Johnson was accepted as a Shaker brother at the main location, the two families have been locked in open controversy. The ministry at Canterbury did not accept Johnson as a legitimate believer because several years earlier, when the last covenanted brother died, the ministry chose to close the order officially, resigning the society to eventual extinction. They did so in part because tradition required new converts to confess their sins to a member of their own sex. When brothers were no longer present, confession was impossible for new male converts. Johnson's presence in the main family therefore caused open schism between the two villages. For the past 25 years, the two groups have had very little to do with one another, except to call each other's names. Call each other names in a not-so-private way and to seek legal redress one against another. Lawyers for both sides have played a central role in this feud because there is a large trust fund that exists for the stated purpose of taking care of the needs of covenanted believers. Theodore Johnson died unexpectedly in 1986, but the problem of new members did not go away. Four of the eight Shakers at Sabbath Day Lake, Maine today are members of the new generation of believers. Their status is at controversy between the two villages. In other words, for the past 25 years or so, the United Society of Believers, which prides itself on the principle of union, has been anything but united. So why does the romanticized view of the Shakers remain so powerfully attractive today? I think there are several reasons for the persistence of this idealized image. One reason is the extraordinary influence exercised by Edward Deming Andrews, a pioneer in 20th century Shaker studies and the chief architect of the prevailing attitude. Acclaimed by one and all as the consummate authority on the society, Andrews put Shakerism on the scholarly map and offered a perspective which has had an immense impact. Andrews literally rescued the believers from the fringes of American life. He made the Shakers appealing, not threatening. Andrews identified them with qualities that many Americans admire: a solid work ethic, inventiveness, sincerity, honesty, commitment to religion, and practicality. He showed their heroic side by featuring their willingness to suffer persecution for what they believed. He created a good feeling about the believers. Andrews situated them in serene and tidy agricultural villages, a setting worlds apart from late 20th century urban America. The splendor of the believers' material culture became the lens through which Andrews viewed all aspects of the society. His love of Shaker things took on the character of a mystical experience, and his interaction with the believers through word and deed and object displayed the marks of a religious relationship. As time passed, he came to regard himself as the elect guardian, and this is his language, of a richly productive strain in American history. His unending fascination with Shaker artifacts left its stamp upon his scholarship. Among his many publications, the most important was the survey entitled The People Called Shakers, published in 1953 and still available today. That volume has become the canonical text on the Shakers. In it, Andrews sketched a highly sympathetic portrait of the society, featuring certain primitive Christian principles, and that's his category, that he found admirable. He identified authentic Shaker religion with spirit-directed impulses and charismatic gifts. He found the same positive religious values embodied in the believer's artifacts. The products of Shaker hands in his judgments mirrored the simplicity and harmony of village life. He celebrated the believer's faith because he himself had been nurtured by their spiritual as well as their material gifts. Andrews wrote, "Precious were these fruits of the Shaker tree of life." In his account, there was little or no room for conflict and dissent, failure, or crass materialism. The Andrews synthesis remains very attractive today for those enamored with the Shakers, for those who wish to see the believers as the pure embodiment of the principles of community, integrity, simplicity, craftsmanship, and agrarian values, virtues traditionally associated with American life but now seemingly far removed from our experience. A strong current of nostalgia feeds the contemporary renaissance of interest in the Shakers. This highly sentimentalized view allows us to see them, and in them ourselves, as Van Culpen suggests, as we might wish them to be instead of as they were and as we are. This romanticized image has been stripped of all offensive features that once set the Shakers apart from other Americans. Their radical religious views, including dissenting judgments about the dual nature of God, the redemptive role of Ann Lee, the condemnation of traditional family life, the critique of private property, and acquisitive capitalism. In other words, the Andrews synthesis downplays the essential sectarian nature of the Shakers. The same image has much to offer those who wish to capitalize upon the believer's artifacts. The mythical Shaker is attractive to those who have a considerable investment in the Shaker enterprise. The commercial prospects associated with this revival of interest in the society have been proven over and over. It is infinitely easier to sell a Shaker who warmly embraces the principles of beauty, utility, and simplicity than one who, on the basis of radical religious ideas, denounces the world as carnal, acquisitive, and selfish. Artifacts are an essential link in this transaction. Americans love things more than ideas. Consumerism is our way of life. Things have another advantage, too. Chairs and oval boxes, brooms and baskets like Rorschach blots do not talk back or tell of conflict and dissent, tension and trouble among the believers. In a word, the prevailing image of the Shakers is very marketable. The material culture of the believers figures centrally in this renaissance of interest in the society. Shaker things have come to symbolize innocence and simplicity, virtue and integrity. In doing so, however, the objects no longer function simply as artifacts, but they have rather gone through a cultural metamorphosis from artifacts to icons. The category of artifact implies utility and function. Virtually everything the Shakers made with their hands was intended to be used. Chairs were for sitting. Oval boxes were containers. Clocks kept time. Planes cut molding. The category of icon, by contrast, suggests in its very name an image or a symbol of something else. An icon is a material representation of a spiritual reality, the sign of something greater than itself. An icon has a sacramental dimension. It becomes a channel or a vehicle of grace and power. It's intended to reveal, instruct, and inspire. For many today, the material objects created by the believers assume a sacramental quality. No longer valued for their practical usefulness, these icons, chairs, baskets, boxes, tables, assume a greater significance as objects of aesthetic beauty, financial security, or spiritual value. Artifacts are useful in their own right. Icons are treasured because they point to some higher power. But why do we idealize the Shakers and create icons of their material culture in the late 20th century? One reason perhaps stems from the changing situation of the Shakers themselves. By mid-century, the community was only a shadow of its former self, consisting mostly of elderly folks, mostly women, many of whom were reconciled to the eventual extinction of the society. The Shakers threatened no one, socially, economically, or religiously. By mid-century, they were harmless, almost pitiable. At precisely the same time, Americans were struggling with post-war developments, ranging from fears generated by the atom bomb and international communism to anxieties associated with the expansion of suburban culture and the quest for affluence. To these concerns would be added during the next decades debate among Americans about war, racial injustice, poverty, urban blight, family values, the drug culture, the environment, gender issues, sexual preference, to name but the most obvious public issues. These were the circumstances that Robert Bella in 1967 described as a time of crisis facing the nation, a crisis of self-confidence. Americans, he wrote, had lost faith in their own world. It was a time of trial for the Republic, he said, as citizens groped for a set of common beliefs and a more stable situation. These were precisely the same decades when a resurgence of conservative evangelicalism occurred in America. Dean Kelly tried to explain the appeal of that movement by the widespread desire for unambiguous answers and clarity of values. The romanticized image of the Shakers has much to offer those who consciously or subconsciously wish for a better world. In the Shakers, Americans have projected a utopian society filled with peaceful, orderly, harmonious, hardworking, ingenious, sincere people who rose above the acquisitive spirit and shared the labors of their hands with one another, living on the land as brothers and sisters. Conveniently, we view the products of their hands as proof positive of these virtues. The Shakers have become an ideal type, a convenient symbol for what was right and what we hope can be in America. Their material culture is hands-on evidence to our way of thinking that such a world once existed and can exist again, if only in our minds. In other words, the renaissance of interest in Shakerism tells us as much or more about the hopes and dreams of the people who are fascinated by the believers and their material culture as it tells us about the Shakers themselves. In closing, let me return to Thomas Merton and the contemporary Shakers with whom we began this lecture. Merton clearly admired Shaker material culture, yet he was not unwilling to smother the prophetic spirit of the Shakers under a pile of oval boxes, chairs, furniture, and other objects. He hoped for a renewal of the role of believers as social critics and prophets. He also feared, and I now quote, an era in which the spiritual imagination is impotent, sterile, and dead, is necessarily going to be an era of violence, chaos, destruction, madness, and slaughter, end quote. His fears, unfortunately, seem to be confirmed by events of our day. Sister Frances Carr, in a recent interview, put the same point a little differently. In commenting on an auction of Shaker objects which grossed more than $1 million, she said, "You've all heard the expression, God writes straight with crooked lines." She continued, "I think that was demonstrated at the auction when a helper at the auction made the comment, 'Someone said it always rains when we have these auctions.' And a man looked up to the sky and said, 'It's the old Shaker's crying.'"